You've probably heard that wild women don't get the blues. But hiking in wild places can give lesbian women the blues when they consider their vulnerability to hate crimes. Same goes for gay men or transgender people. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Today we talk to adults who are finding safety in numbers when exploring the outdoors. And from outdoors to indoors, we learn about fermenting food and drink from a master of the art. Plus, a way station for migrating monarch butterflies in the city. All this and more is coming your way. Please stay tuned to the Allegheny Front. One Pennsylvania lawmaker wants to make environmental protection an election issue, but not in the way you might think. Jesse White, a state representative in Washington County, says he wants the state's top environmental regulator to be an elected official. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
White thinks the Department of Environmental Protection under Governor Tom Corbett has gotten too cozy with the gas industry, and he wants to make its leader elected by voters instead of appointed by the governor. White decided to draft legislation that did just that after a DEP investigation into noxious odors at a health clinic in his district. The clinic, Cornerstone Care, was closed earlier this year because of strong chemical smells in one part of the building. DEP tests to find a source were inconclusive. In its search for a source for the odors, the agency ruled out a Marcellus Shale gas rig a quarter mile from the clinic. But, citing its own policy, it would not release the raw data collected at the gas rig or the clinic to White's office. White believes the agency is under political pressure from the Corbett administration to go easy on the gas industry, and he thinks voters, not the governor, should choose the state's top environmental cop.
You've got a branch or a segment of government with huge responsibility and power with no accountability to the people.
The Corbett administration says the DEP has not gone easy on drillers, and thinks the current system works just fine, thank you. In a statement, a spokesman said the current setup allows the head of DEP to be, quote, answerable to the laws and not the polls. White admits the bill is a long shot to be taken up by the legislature anytime soon. As a constitutional amendment, it would need to be passed twice by the legislature, then put on the ballot in a subsequent referendum. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
After nearly a quarter century, Allegheny County is on the cusp of updating its air pollution guidelines. The proposed air toxic guidelines are up for a health department vote on Wednesday. They're the work of a task force of 20-some people and include new chemical exposure limits and regulations to emissions from smaller businesses than in the past. Several business groups are seeking to delay the new guidelines. The Allegheny Front's Patrick Wagner visited the neighborhoods of Avalon and Oakland to find out what people are saying about air pollution.
I am a student at the University of Pittsburgh and I live in Oakland. My name is Brittany Reyes. I'm actually from D.C., so I've been here for 3 years and I definitely have been seeing a general push within at least the student body to improve air quality control, and I think it's really great.
My name is Brandon Alberg. I'm a student at the University of Pittsburgh. I think being in a city with tons of businesses and lots of cars and fumes, it's hard to keep good air quality. But if this legislation passes after they do their review, I hope that it will help better increase the air quality.
Steve Harding from Avalon. If you turn around right behind me here, down there is Neville Island. There's a gigantic factory that you can see smoke coming up over the hill all the time. I often wonder, you know, if that's actually affecting the health of people in this area. And it's something that, you know, I probably won't be a long-term resident in Avalon because of.
My name is Beverly Humbert. I'm from Avalon. Since I moved here 7 years ago, I'm coughing all the time. I cannot keep my windowsills or anything clean. I get that black soot all over the windows. It comes in the house, through the furnace filters. Black soot all the time.
My name is James Smith. I live up here in Bellevue. From what I can see and from what I can feel, the air quality is okay, you know, up here in Bellevue, you know. But now the inner city, you know, it means you can basically see it. Out in Braddock, you can still basically see it. You know, the air quality is just real thick, just like it used to be back in like the 60s and 70s.
My name's Anthony Schoenkrupp. I'm from Kennedy Township, Pennsylvania. We have the worst air quality in Allegheny County, and I blame that number one on Neville Allen. I know how bad it is here, and I work in it all day long. There's a ton of toxins in the air that aren't just from our vehicles, that aren't just from, you know, diesel trucks. They're from those plants.
Some business groups, Marcellus Shale Industry, PPG, U.S. Steel, have said that we need more time to look at what's going on. Is that
time? They've been in business since the dawn of time, since mine and your grandfather, before they were even thought about being born. How much time do they need? I don't want to hear time. Fix it.
You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Those were the voices of people responding to a proposal to change the Allegheny County Health Department's air pollution standards. The audio was recorded by the Allegheny Front's Patrick Wagner in Avalon and Oakland. Many people head to the woods to get away from it all. But for gays and lesbians, sometimes getting away means walking into another set of problems.
We had to make a pretty quick dash out of here. I thought we were going to get beat up. It was definitely scary. I didn't come down here for a while afterwards.
That's coming up later on the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Please stay tuned. There are controversies swirling around local and organic foods these days. Recently, Stanford researchers reviewed 200 food studies and concluded that organic and conventionally grown foods provide pretty much the same nutrition. Irate defenders of organics have claimed that the study's authors are anti-organic. The Allegheny Front's Hal B. Klein finds there's a similar conflict brewing over food miles. That's the idea that eating from within a certain radius of where you live is better for the environment than eating food that's shipped long distances.
Pierre Desrochers is a professor of geography at the University of Toronto. Since 2008, he's been researching and writing about the concept of food miles. That's the total distance food travels from farm to consumer. The new book he co-authored, The Locavore's Dilemma, considers economic and environmental impacts of various foods. Take apples. While they're practically falling off local trees now.
If you want to eat it in March or April, you need to leave it in cold storage for several months, which has a huge energy footprint.
He says the better choice is to look to New Zealand or Chile.
You put them on a container ship, which is by far the most efficient way of moving things that the human brains have ever devised. And so it is cheaper, it is better, it is fresher. And what this really shows you is that the mode of transportation matters a lot more than the distance traveled.
It may not be so simple, though. That's according to Michael Finewood, who teaches a class on food and climate change at Chatham University's School of Sustainability.
Food miles is obviously an important metric here, but it is just one metric. There's a whole bunch of other factors at play. How much we waste, how much meat we eat, what we eat, where we go for food, how we preserve food, even down to packaging.
He says that if we address these broader issues, then the local food movement begins to make more sense. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Hal B. Klein.
Speaking of seasonal foods, the tastes and smells of this time of year are perfectly captured in a poem by the late Pennsylvania native John Updike. It's read by the Allegheny Front's Joey Spihar.
September by John Updike. The breezes taste of apple peel. The air is full of smells to feel. Ripe fruit, old footballs, burning brush, new books, erasers, chalk and such. The bee, his hive, well-honeyed hum, and mother cuts chrysanthemums like plates washed clean with suds. The days are polished with a morning haze.
That was the Allegheny Front's Joey Spihar reading from John Updike's poem, September.
Chasing.
Go to the farmer's market this time of year, and you might be tempted to buy a little bit of everything. There's so many perfectly ripe tomatoes, peaches, zucchini, and they're only fresh so briefly. Historically, people have taken advantage of this annual moment by preserving foods through fermentation. If you're interested in trying to follow our cultural path of culturing foods or just reading some fascinating fermentation stories, Sander Katz has written a book called The Art of Fermentation. He'll be speaking at Pennsylvania's Seven Springs Mountain Resort later this month at the Mother Earth News Fair. For a preview, he joins me on the phone from his home in Tennessee. Sander, you were on our program a couple years ago. Thanks for joining me again.
It is my pleasure to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Take me back to what it first was when you were a child that got you interested in fermentation.
Well, I would say that my interest in fermentation, you know, developed in a few different stages. As a kid growing up in New York City, I just loved to eat sour pickles. And for reasons I cannot explain, I always have been drawn to the flavor of lactic acid and lactic acid fermentation. But I didn't grow up around people who were making it themselves. They were abundantly available in delicatessens in New York. You know, I really didn't get involved in making my own, fermentations until I moved from New York City to rural Tennessee 20 years ago. And when I was faced with all of the cabbages being ready at the same time for the first time, right, keeping a garden, I remembered how much I loved sauerkraut and started investigating how to make it.
So there are a number of little anecdotes and recipes throughout the book by others who share your love of fermentation. One is from a man in Italy, and I mentioned tomatoes. That's much on people's minds. His was a description of how to make raw tomato preserves, and it involves letting...
Oh, yeah, that is so good.
You've made it? It sounds amazing. Yeah. It involves letting the mashed tomatoes, though, grow mold, which is scary to a lot of people, mixing it in and repeating. And it says that European regulations have made the sale of this illegal. Can you talk about why fermentation is a scary and illegal thing around the world and that people leave to the commercial sector now?
Well, I mean, let me say that. I mean, fermentation is not a scary and illegal thing. That people, you know, it's legal. I mean, you know, 1/3 of all food that human beings put into our mouths are produced by fermentation. You know, if you take the brewing industry and the baking industry and the cheese making industry, you know, together those constitute a huge sector of the economy. So, you know, these are not underground illegal activities. I mean, you know, some of our aesthetics around food safety have shifted. I mean, I hear all the time from people who are trying to start small fermentation-related businesses, and then they get some health inspector who, you know, just knows nothing about fermentation and tries to tell them that it's inherently unsafe to age food for more than 4 hours outside of refrigeration. You know, and then what they do is they point out how many products are commonly sold in, you know, in supermarkets that are not possible without leaving food outside of refrigeration for some period of time. And so, you know, it becomes an economic development issue. Can we only eat those foods if they come from a centralized plant far away? You know, or can we learn how to, you know, safely, you know, use traditional techniques that produce, you know, incredibly compelling flavors that people continue to love everywhere?
Would you suggest these fears are completely unreasonable? Like, can you get botulism?
The USDA reports that there never has been a single case of food poisoning from fermented vegetables in the United States. There are very few foods that you could say that about. And this suggests that the process of fermentation makes vegetables safer.
You talk a bit about the environmental benefits of fermentation, the fact it's a low energy, in fact, no energy, oftentimes process that predates the need for electric refrigeration. But when I've made sauerkraut, I stop the culturing process by refrigerating it or freeze it. Maybe I don't need to.
I mean, it's all about what you like. I mean, you know, one thing I've learned about sharing sauerkraut with people and teaching people how to make sauerkraut is some people like it mild after just a few days of fermentation, and some people prefer it when it's more mature, has a stronger flavor, after it becomes more acidic, which takes a longer time. There's also also an environmental factor in the equation, which is temperature. All of the ferments go faster through their process when the temperatures are warmer, slower when they're cooler. Some of them will only occur within specific temperature parameters, but something like sauerkraut, you can do it really at any temperature as long as you understand that it will go much faster in hot weather than it will in cool weather or in a cellar.
A lot of people bake with working with yeast. One of the tips in the book mentions the chlorine that's commonly in our water killing active cultures in yeast, and therefore, you know, recommends letting the water age a bit so the chlorine can evaporate.
Well, I think that, you know, in terms of its direct bearing upon fermentation, the chlorine that's added, because it's added specifically to kill bacteria, is the most problematic. But I mean, you know, certainly the quality of our drinking water is of, you know, broader concern than our ability to ferment food. There are other chemicals in water, you know, ranging from chemicals that are intentionally added, like fluoride, to you know, chemicals, pharmaceutical chemicals, like pesticide chemicals. So you know, our water really is quite heavily chemically laden right now, and you know, we are learning. I'm certainly not an expert, but we are learning about more and more ways that impacts upon our health, and there may be subtle ways that they're impacting upon the microorganisms that I have not become aware of. But I would say, you know, the biggest thing is the chlorine in water. You know, carbon filtration can remove the chlorine, evaporation can remove the chlorine, but many water systems are working with a non-volatile form of chlorine mixed with ammonia that's called chloramine. And the chloramine does not evaporate.
I have some notes from your publicist that suggests fermentation can address peak oil and climate change. And
well,
really?
Sure. I mean, you know, when you talk to people who live without refrigeration, I mean, these foods become much more important. I mean, you know, salami and cheese and sauerkraut are foods that can sit on your counter for a very long time without refrigeration. So, you know, absolutely. I mean, you know, right now in the American context, we're all living with fermentation slowing devices in our kitchens. Electricity is cheap. It doesn't cost us a lot to keep them going. You know, if the if the equation should change and suddenly energy would become much more expensive, and it does not be, and it no longer remains tenable for, you know, each household to have their own fermentation slowing devices, we're going to have to rely much more heavily you know, on foods that preserve themselves, usually with acids from fermentation.
Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Okie doke, it's my pleasure.
I've been talking with the Art of Fermentation author, Sander Katt. He'll be at the Mother Earth News Fair starting September 21st at Seven Springs. More information at AlleghenyFront.org. His Twitter handle is Sander Kraut. Mine's Jennifer Schvetta. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Our last guest just spoke about some of the problems with public drinking water supplies. But more than 3 million Pennsylvanians get their drinking water from wells on their properties. If you're one of them, you might be wondering how to keep that water safe. The Department of Environmental Protection is offering a webinar series. The topic on September 19th is private well maintenance. The Allegheny Front's Janelle Pfeiffer has this.
The evening webinars are free to attend and last no longer than an hour. Each will have a set agenda, but still allow time for Q&As with DEP experts. Spokeswoman Amanda Whitman says at different times of the year, different issues are at hand.
August will be focusing on water wells and how to keep your well safe. In October, we will actually be focusing on energy conservation because that is Energy Conservation Month. And then in January, we'll be focusing on radon, which is an issue that really becomes important in the winter months because of homes being closed up and not having windows open and things of that nature.
The first session held in June centered around topics like West Nile virus, black fly spraying, and ozone action days. If you missed the live webinar, no worries. Whitman says you can get the information online by clicking the DEP at Home button on the homepage. You can also find details there on how to register for the next talk in August. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Janelle Pfeiffer.
fall weather's here, and it's time for monarch butterflies to hightail it to Mexico on their annual migration. Pittsburgh's Convention Center is trying to help the butterflies along on their journeys by planting milkweed and other flower varieties. The Allegheny Front's Ashley Murray reports from downtown Pittsburgh.
I'm here at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center with Mark Leahy, the general manager, and Jim Bonner of the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania. We're on this very large observation deck overlooking the Allegheny River, and there's about 44 large planters here. Mark, what made the Convention Center get into the business of helping monarch butterflies travel to Mexico?
Our director of sales and marketing came across an article that talked about the declining habitat for monarch butterflies. Pittsburgh, the whole Pittsburgh area, is on the migratory patterns and the migratory routes of these monarch butterflies that leave Mexico, go up to Canada, swing back around, and head south again. So they need to eat along the way. And we had these areas, and let's put them to good use. And of course, the big question has been, have you seen any butterflies?
So have you seen any butterflies?
Oh, we have indeed. We knew that September would be the time for them. And one of our staff was up here, and she quickly took a picture and emailed it to just about everybody, and I felt like a proud parent.
And here is a full-grown adult monarch caterpillar. This guy's here about 2 inches long. It's probably only days away from going into a chrysalis. So when this one comes out in about anywhere from, again, 10 days, 2 weeks from now, that's most likely the one that'll start to head south towards Mexico on the migration.
Do you think that he will make it to Mexico?
Hard to say odds on any one particular one. I'd love to root for this one since it's our first one. And he looks like a fighter, so I'll put some money on him. He's just chawing down there. You know, he doesn't really matter, you know, mind so much that he's kind of being lifted up by me. He's just continuing to eat away on the plant. Milkweed, which is the kind of the key plant to this, is sometimes a much maligned plant. So a lot of it was removed. It is the only plant that the caterpillars can eat and consume. And so without milkweed, you can't have monarch butterflies.
If listeners see a monarch fluttering past them, is it safe to say that that monarch is migrating?
Most likely they are seeing ones that are on their path south.
That was the Allegheny Front's Ashley Murray at a monarch butterfly way station atop Pittsburgh's David Lawrence Convention Center. With Convention Center General Manager Mark Leahy and Jim Bonner of the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania. You're listening to the Allegheny Front.
Hi, I'm Joey Spihar, the Allegheny Front's production director, and now, our weekly quiz question. In Canada, monarch butterflies are called King Billy. For whom are they named, and why? You can go to our Facebook page to answer, direct message us on Twitter at Allegheny Front, or email AlleghenyFrontQuiz@gmail.com.
Lots of people can feel intimidated by the great outdoors, but for some gay and transgender people, being in the outdoors can be downright dangerous. 15 years ago, two gay women were murdered in a hate crime on the Appalachian Trail in Virginia. Earlier this year, lesbian women in Kentucky were asked to leave a park because of their sexual orientation. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple has this story on the risks and rewards of being out in the outdoors. Several of the people in this story ask that their full or real names not be used because they fear discrimination.
Chris Stahl steps down a gravel path to a clearing where he was harassed several years ago in this urban Pittsburgh park.
It used to be a field down here, but it totally changed over to wetlands. Like they put all.
Stahl's a fit transgender man in his early 40s with a goatee. When he and a friend were walking here, they came upon a group of men playing football.
I think I was only on testosterone for under a year, so not all the effects had quite taken place yet. They couldn't determine what gender I was and proceeded to say some very harassing, not so nice things when we got right about here.
Stahl decided to confront them, but it didn't go well.
We had to make a pretty quick dash out of here. I thought we were going to get beat up. It was definitely scary. I didn't come down here for a while afterwards.
While most news headlines on gay rights focus on jobs and marriage, there's little discussion about protecting people in public spaces, like state and community parks. Yet in Pennsylvania and other states, no overarching state human relations act expressly says that gay and transgender people are guaranteed access to public accommodations. Ted Martin is with Equality Pennsylvania, a gay and transgender rights group. He says in 70% of the state, people could be denied services in stores or recreation in parks just for being perceived as gay or transgender.
You know, I think that the people don't understand that. I think people don't feel that that is a reality, or they feel that it's covered elsewhere. And the fact of the matter is, in Pennsylvania, it is not.
Martin says there's no legal recourse for gay and transgender people in these areas where the law isn't on their side. Some communities do have such legislation, but not Washington County, where a gay woman who goes by the name Cinders lives and works. She's the organizer of Wilderness Women and Friends, a group that gets gay women together outdoors. On this sunny, late summer morning, Cinders is carefully selecting logs from a loose pile in her yard.
I'm a scavenger, but this time around, there was a maple tree right over there that didn't quite make it.
This is Wilderness Women's first work party.
So I kind of put out the call, and sure enough, I've got a couple of complete strangers I've never met before are going to show up and help me to split firewood.
She says the group helps build community for gay women and the men and friends who tag along, and a sense of safety in numbers.
I think sometimes we feel intimidated. I think that sometimes we feel alone. So to have a group of folks that we can play outdoors with is more fun.
Like other gay outdoors groups, they advertise their bike rides, camping, and field trips on a website and a listserv for the gay community. As Cinders pulls the chain and revs up the log splitter, two others, Lynn and Anne, arrive. Lynn says, as a lesbian, she's felt more than a little intimidated outdoors, even though she's an experienced camper.
Oh yeah, all the time. You get, because especially at campgrounds or stuff like that, you got to be so careful. Especially, I don't know, I get scared, you know, sometimes at night.
Cinder says she's never felt discriminated against in the outdoors. She thinks people who love the outdoors are friendlier and kinder. It's been a different story in her work and other areas of her life. There, as anywhere, discrimination can be subtle or more overt. But she says it all starts with preconceived notions about who gay and transgender women and men are, and she sees that changing.
I think it gets better as we find that there are more people who are all about who you are and not about what they perceive you are.
For many gay, bisexual, and transgender people, that means being less afraid to display their gay pride bumper stickers while pulling into their campsites. And Cinders says gives a wilderness woman the opportunity to enjoy the outdoors like anyone else. She mentions a bumper sticker you might have seen that says, "Wild women don't get the blues," and how for her, it's kind of true.
To me, wild means that I'm at peace with nature as far as I'm at home in my natural setting. That's what a wild woman is.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
Thanks so much for listening to The Allegheny Front. You can follow us on Twitter at Allegheny Front or visit our website, alleghenyfront.org. Joey Spiehart is our production director and our poetry recitation artist. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Please join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on The Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments, the Remmel Foundation, administered by PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Laurel Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation and the Curtis and Edith Munson Foundation support coverage of Marcellus Shale issues.